Saturday, Sunday, we had 20,000 lightning strikes roughly and, 60 new fire starts.
A busy weekend for firefighters in the interior. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, June 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Fairbanks makes an arrest in Ohio in a murder case from last May.
We had discovered his whereabouts were down there. And then, we actually did travel down to speak with him and to serve an arrest warrant.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. Mount Edgecombe High School provides a curriculum rich in culture and diversity, offering over 80 courses, from art to advanced engineering, and with activities from native dance to kayaking. Class sizes are no larger than 30. Explore your talents and develop your dreams. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
The University of Alaska Board of Regents is set to decide next steps for the partially completed engineering building at the Fairbanks campus. The Fairbanks Daily News Miner reports the board will hold a special meeting to vote on $37.5 million in bonds that will allow the building to be completed. President Jim Johnson approved the meeting, saying the building is an opportunity waiting for investment. The project had started after the Alaska legislature approved funding for it, as well as an engineering building for the Anchorage campus in 2012. But progress on the UAF project has stalled in recent years amid the state's multi-billion dollar budget deficit. The University of Alaska Anchorage engineering building opened for classes last fall. Firefighting resources were stretched over the weekend as dozens of new fires were sparked by lightning across the interior. Alaska Division of Forestry spokesman Tim Mowry says thunderstorm activity resulted in starts from the Brooks Range to the Alaska Range.
Saturday, Sunday, we had 20,000 lightning strikes roughly and, 60 new fire starts or reports. And it sort of went from west to east, right across the middle of the state.
Mowry says numerous fires drew responses, including in the Fairbanks area.
It was like musical fires. We were sending, initial attack in one fire, and we'd get some resources on that, and we'd have to go check out another fire. And at one point we had demobbed smoke jumpers from a fire up by Chattanooga, the Washington Creek fire.
And they were pulled from that fire, got it back to Fairbanks, and were sent out to a fire nearby Poker Flats area.
Bureau of Land Management Alaska Fire Service spokeswoman Beth Ibsen says the frantic pace continued late into Sunday night, but the thunderstorms also brought rain to many areas, giving state and federal response agencies a chance to regroup today.
Kind of getting an idea of, okay, which areas are receiving precipitation, which areas are forecasted to get some rain, and then go from there.
A number of the new fires reported over the weekend are burning in limited protection areas and not being fought. A Norwegian tanker ran aground near Nunavak Island on Friday, according to a U.S. Coast Guard press release. The chemical tanker was carrying more than 14 million gallons of fuel when it hit bottom a little after 9 a.m. on Friday. The 24-member crew was able to refloat the vessel minutes after the grounding and anchored in deeper water. While the crew saw no initial sign of a spill, the Coast Guard sent a C-130 Hercules airplane from Kodiak. The flyover confirmed no visible pollution from the grounding. According to the Coast Guard, the weather at the time of the incident was calm, with 3-foot seas. The alleged shooter of John Kvaerluk Jr. has been arrested by Fairbanks police. Kvaerluk was gunned down outside of the Rock and Rodeo Bar in Fairbanks last May. Arrested is Patrick Dale Burton, age 23. He was located in Cleveland, Ohio, and is currently in custody awaiting possible extradition to Alaska on charges of first-degree murder. Fairbanks Police Detective Peyton Meredith says unlike the previous two out-of-state arrests in connection to the Kvaerluk homicide, when U.S. Marshals and local police conducted the arrests, this time Fairbanks Police picked up Burton themselves.
We didn't require the assistance of anybody else other than the Cuyahoga County Sheriff's Office. We had discovered his whereabouts. We're down there. And then, we actually did travel down to speak with him and to serve an arrest warrant.
On May 16th of last year, Kavaraluk took his wife, Shailene, to the Rockin' Rodeo on the Old Steese Highway in Fairbanks for their first night out after the birth of their daughter roughly a month earlier. Burton was also at the bar with a group of three other men. Charging documents suggest that Kavaraluk tried to defend his wife from an unwelcome advance by one of the four suspects. A fight broke out in the bar, and the men were ejected. As the altercation continued in the parking lot, Burton allegedly retrieved a 9mm handgun from a vehicle and shot Kavaraluk multiple times. Detective Meredith says the investigation into Kavaraluk's death has been extensive and exhausting, stemming from the fact that the suspects were not from Fairbanks.
Just like the other suspects in the case, I mean, it was just a matter of literally thousands of hours put in by our office trying to track these guys down and identify who they were. And then we finally were able to identify who the actual shooter was, which of course was on video. We just needed to put a name with a face.
Two of Burton's companions at the Rockin' Rodeo were arrested last fall. Joel Roland Joseph and Demarius Hinson are in custody at the Fairbanks Correctional Center. A hearing on their cases is scheduled for this Thursday in Fairbanks Superior Court, with a trial date currently set for the week of August 15th. Joseph is charged with first and second degree murder and has pled not guilty. Hinson and Joseph are also charged with hindering prosecution. Both fled the state after the incident. John Kavaraluk was a 2010 graduate of the Galena Interior Learning Academy and originally from the village of Koyuk. He was working as a plumber in Fairbanks at the time of his death. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, biologists look at how tourists are affecting seal populations near Yakutat.
If that period of hauling out is disturbed by humans, it has a consequence. And we're trying to see if we can measure that consequence.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The MBA program at Alaska Pacific University provides working professionals an educational pathway to career advancement. Through APU's hybrid course format of online and campus-based courses, students can focus on healthcare, finance, technology, and strategic leadership options. Apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Summer is an important time for seal pup development. So the federal government is asking vessels like cruise ships to stay farther away from harbor seals in glacial fjords. Biologists are tracking the population in Disenchantment Bay near Yakutat to see how the new guidelines are working. But first, they have to catch the pups. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
Tagging 45 precocious baby seals is no easy task. That's the number John Jansen, a federal biologist, has in mind.
The mesh bag will go on the hook side, but then I was thinking we'd put a paddle through it.
His crew is getting ready to float through the water near the face of Hubbard Glacier. The plan? Catch the pups as they drift by on hunks of glacial ice.
Our first attempt is going to be just using a small dip net and kind of trying to approach them in a stealthy way.
Of course, mama seals can make this difficult. It's easier if they scoop up a pup before she notices they're around. Once Jansen and his crew catch a seal, they'll glue a satellite transmitter to its fur, either on its back or its head.
Because that's the only part that typically comes out of the water when they're surfacing at sea. And those have been kind of equated with party hats.
And when he's back in his Seattle office, Jansen will be able to see the pup, just a small dot on his computer screen. It sounds like a seal version of Big Brother, but the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration wants to know how much time pups spend hauling out on the ice. It's an important time for seals to rest. And for baby seals, it's a chance to fatten up.
So there is a really critical function of hauling out, and if that period of hauling out is disturbed by humans, it has a consequence. And we're trying to see if we can measure that consequence.
This video was shot on a sightseeing tour in Disenchantment Bay. It's a popular spot to see massive hunks of the Hubbard Glacier fall into the water, and seals are resting on icebergs nearby. But the ships sometimes scare the seals into the water.
In the Yakutat, we harvest seal, and so the seal population has to stay healthy.
Victoria Demard is the president of the Yakutat tribe. She says local hunters became concerned in the late 90s when they noticed fewer seals in Disenchantment Bay, and they wondered if an increase in tourism was affecting the population. So NOAA started monitoring the seals. Over the years, the federal agency has observed, yes, large vessels are causing the seals to spend less time on the ice. Dimmert says that's a growing concern for the tribe.
And we understand, you know, that they want to show off the area for their passengers, but we need them to be considerate.
The old marine viewing guidelines advise vessels to stay 100 yards away from seals. They were created before the boom of tourism. Aleria Jensen, a NOAA stranding coordinator, says that's no longer adequate in glacial fjords. So the agency came up with new guidelines, and public comment was taken. NOAA had two options: make it voluntary or required through regulation.
And the agency decided to go with a voluntary approach. So there are some measures that are meant to apply to glacial fjords across Alaska.
Vessels are now being asked to stay 500 yards away from seals. Jensen says NOAA realizes the tour industry offers the state a significant economic boost.
And so the goal here is to protect seals without compromising opportunities for high-quality glacial viewing experiences and wildlife viewing experiences, but finding the balance.
Soon, NOAA and the National Park Service will be closer to figuring out what that balance is. They'll use this summer's research to determine exactly how the vessels impact the growing seals. For example, how much time are they really spending on the ice? Back in Disenchantment Bay, John Jansen and his team are giving a seal pup a haircut. Actually, they're taking hair and whiskers samples to bring back to the lab.
Okay, let's do the tag.
Tag.
Then they glue on the tracking device.
And we just want to make sure that the rise in the presence of humans in some of these really pristine environments is not putting those populations at risk. We want to make sure that they're there for everyone to enjoy in the long term.
After a while, the seal mom swims around to check on her baby.
Hi.
That's just freaking awesome.
When the biologists are finished, they'll dip the pup back into the water with a new haircut and new hardware. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
One of Sea Alaska's most vocal critics is now a member of the Southeast Regional Native Corporation's board of directors. Shareholders chose Michael Beasley, also known as Mick, as one of four winning candidates, according to results announced at Sea Alaska's annual meeting on Saturday in Ketchikan. He came in behind three incumbents. They are Inside Passage Electric Cooperative CEO Jody Mitchell, Clinkett and Haida Business Corporation CEO Richard Reinhart, and National Congress of American Indians Executive Director Jackie Johnson Peta. A fourth incumbent, Patrick Anderson, ran as an independent and lost. Beasley, a carver, authored a term limits measure on this year's ballot. It received a majority of the votes cast, but not the majority of all possible ballots. As a result, it will not take effect. Beasley has put similar measures on Sea Alaska's ballot in the past. Four other independent candidates also ran for the 13-member board. Cold Bay to Unalaska is nearly 200 miles. By plane, it takes about an hour. By kayak, it's nearly a month. Akio Shinia made the trip with three others in 24 days. KUCB's Zoe Sobel spoke with him before he returned to Japan.
I am old man, 69 years old, so very hard, but now I am happy.
That's Akio Shinia. Over the past 16 years, he has taken six kayak trips to the Aleutian Islands, a place he considers special.
Kayak was born here, Aleutian Island chain. They have big history. So I interest to the ancient people and Aleutian now.
Shinya lives on Japan's northern island, Hokkaido, in the village of Niseko, where he runs a ski lodge. In the summers, he operates a kayak tour business, and occasionally, he takes people on expeditions to the Aleutians. The kayakers are completely self-sufficient. They carry all their own food and camping supplies. They paddle collapsible kayaks designed to be easily transported and assembled without tools. The Japanese prefer these boats because they have an outer skin stretched over an aluminum frame, similar to the skin-on-frame kayaks designed and used in the Aleutians for thousands of years. Shinya and his co-leader even use traditional Aleut paddles made by a friend in Japan.
Every time Always I use Aleut paddles in Japan and here. This paddle is good for the Aleutian. Paddling is very smooth.
They're wooden with a narrow bridge. Shinya calls himself a student of ancient people. On his trips, he does not use a GPS, satellite phone, or rescue radio because ancient people did not have them. Although this trip is over, he hopes one day to return to the Aleutians.
I know, I'm an old man, and but if possible, more paddling. My experience of Aleutian feels very small.
In Unalaska, I'm Zoe Sobel.
How safe is your raincoat or your carpet? Biophysical chemist Arlene Bloom, the director of the Green Science Policy Institute, is speaking in Anchorage tomorrow about how the chemicals in our everyday items could be impacting our health. She spoke with Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman.
Well, there's certain families of chemicals that are known to be harmful. One example people may not realize is stain repellents, chemicals like Scotchgard, which they're used to make Gore-Tex and Teflon. Those are some of the most persistent chemicals, like they won't break down for a million years. And the ones that have been studied are toxic. So making a choice to use a chemical that never breaks down, that's toxic, is a big choice for the world. And also, if they're going to end up inside of you or your family, a big choice for you.
So this is Alaska. We all rely fairly heavily on things like Gore-Tex. Is that a problem? Do we need to be concerned about that?
So it's better to limit your use if you really need it. Like I sort of say, well, if you're going to go climb Mount Everest, maybe you really need it. But I actually was the group that made the second American ascent of Everest, and we didn't have any Gore-Tex, and we climbed Everest. But it's also used in bathing suits and surf shorts, so they'll dry faster. Then you don't need it.
And why should we be concerned about having these chemicals around us?
Well, because they are harmful to our health and the health of animals and the environment. And a lot of these chemicals do not occur naturally in any mammals. And so our bodies don't know how to deal with them. So they can just go into our bodies because the defense mechanisms don't see them. And they stay because the things that clean the toxins out of our cells don't recognize them. So they tend to be harmful.
And what kinds of things can they do to our bodies?
Some of them will increase the likelihood of getting cancer. A number of them, for example, flame retardants and stain repellents. When a woman has a higher level in her body, her children are more likely to have neurological impairments, lowered IQ, endocrine disruptors. A lot of them are endocrine disruptors, which means they mess up the hormonal balance in our bodies, which can lead to obesity, diabetes, a lot of different problems.
You're speaking here in Anchorage not just about chemicals, but also about your mountaineering experiences. How do those two intersect?
Well, they're remarkably similar. So I led the first American ascent of Annapurna 1, which has the highest fatality rate of any of the 8,000-meter peaks. And I actually led the first women's ascent of Denali, which was also pretty challenging. And I like to say that when I'm doing my environmental health work, I feel just like I'm on Annapurna or Denali, because we know what the summit is. The summit is a healthier world with less toxic chemicals. And we even kind of know how to get there. But there's avalanches and yetis and storms and many, many obstacles. And you just kind of have to keep picking your foot up and putting it down and plodding upward. And that's kind of how working on chemicals to make the world healthier or climbing mountains. It's a similar patient, painstaking process.
That was chemist and mountaineer Arlene Bloom. She'll be speaking at 7 p.m. tomorrow at Alaska Public Media.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future that delivers oil today and sustains operations for tomorrow. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
More and more Alaska Natives are choosing to use their native language names on social media, at work, and in their everyday lives. It's a cultural shift from previous generations in which many avoided speaking their language, let alone self-identifying with it. Department of Health and Social Services Commissioner Valerie Davidson, however, has been using her Yupik name professionally for about 20 years. In this first installment of a five-part series on Alaska Native names, Davidson talks about the importance of her name as it relates to her role in Alaska's state government.
Valerie Davidson. My names are Nuchagaluk and Mishamakanan Valerie Davidson. I am Yupik, and I am Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. I've always used my Yupik name. I didn't actually know I had an English name until I started school. And when I did, I thought I was in big trouble. For me and for Yupik people, our Yupik names tell who we are related to and where we are from. I've used my Yupik name on my business card for years, for probably about 20 years. And one of the reasons I do that, not only on my business cards, but also when I introduce myself, is because I think it's really important for people to know that Alaska Natives are still here, we are relevant, and we do our part to contribute positively to our state. And I think that's especially important for children to hear. One of the things that has been a really nice surprise is when I send emails from my work email address, I always say at the end, Kuyana. And I've been really pleased how many people have started using that. So, for example, when the governor emails me back, he almost always says Kuyana Val. I've had people ask me when I've said Kuyana to them, what's the appropriate word for you're welcome, which is Ang. And people have started using that. And so it's really nice to be able to just by incorporating that into our everyday work, how we're kind of starting to indigenize a little bit state government in a small way, but that's how big things start, is one step at a time.
That was the first in a five-part series on Alaska Native names produced by KTOO's Jennifer Canfield. A link to a longer interview is at our website, alaskapublic.org. 52 mushers have signed up so far for the 2017 Iditarod. Signups opened on Saturday and include a lengthy list of top names and newcomers. 2016 Iditarod champion Dallas Seavey is set to race alongside his father, Mitch Seavey. Western Alaska veterans Pete Kaiser of Bethel and Richie Deal of Aniak are also set to compete. Some other big names signed up over the weekend include 9 of the top 10 finishers from last year's race. Allie Zirkel and Jeff King will return. Also, Wade Mars, Yor Olsom, Nicholas Petit, and Ralph Johansson. Lance Mackey will attempt another comeback after scratching last year, and armchair musher Sebastian Snula will also be coming out of retirement for the upcoming 2017 race. A total of 40 veterans and 12 rookies have signed up so far. Mushers have until December 1st to throw their hats in the ring. A University of Alaska Fairbanks researcher is working to unravel a lingering mystery of the 9/11/2001 terrorist attack on the World Trade Center in New York City. The collapse of Building 7 near the Twin Towers has long been a centerpiece of theories that the September 11th attacks were part of a government conspiracy. As KYC's Dan Bross reports, UAF engineering professor J. Leroy Halsey is taking a scientific approach to scrutinize what happened to the building.
Dr. J. Leroy Halsey is funded by the group Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth to research what brought down World Trade Center Building 7, the 47-story high-rise collapse 7 hours after the Twin Towers fell over 300 feet away. Halsey says an analysis by the National Institute of Science and Technology attributes the failure to numerous fires ignited inside the high-rise by debris from the Twin Towers.
The expansion of the steel was such that it created a problem. It occurred on the 13th floor with Column 79, and because of that, it collapsed. So I've been asked by Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, who's a group of professionals that have put together their own money to get another opinion.
Halsey says he was connected with the group through a friend. Halsey, who has decades of structural engineering experience around the country, including forensic analysis of building failures, says he's using Building 7 structural drawings to model failure scenarios.
Get the structure put into a digital system that we can simulate its behavior. It's very complicated.
An alternate Building 7 collapse theory says it was a controlled demolition using explosives.
People have put straight lines on the video to see if it goes straight down, and it's almost perfectly straight down. Yet the building is not symmetric. One might say, well, why did that happen? You know, and you can begin to see why people have all these ideas about why that building came straight down like that. And matter of fact, the Twin Towers came down pretty straight, too.
Halsey, who's been working on the project for a year, stresses that he and two graduate students are going about the analysis with open minds.
There's a lot of stuff that's been written about this, and I have absolutely refused to read it. And I'm not going to read it until we have our results finished. And then I've told my students that they are not allowed to read it either. So we do not want to have a bias. We're going to try to do this purely scientifically.
Halsey says after the analysis is completed, he'll read everything he can find about Building 7 theories and welcome feedback.
And we're in the process of putting together a professional team of experts to review our work.
Halsey says he intends to have some key research results available by this coming September 11th, and will give public presentations, including in Alaska. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Emily Russell and Margaret DiMaioribus in Nome, Tim Bedoni in Galena, Elizabeth Jenkins, Jennifer Canfield, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The University of Alaska Southeast specializes in you. UAS is a learning community where your professors or mentors and friends on campus and online. UAS.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org, where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.